Hello, comedy nerds, comedy geeks. I'm Masavia Greer.
And I'm Mike George. And today on Comedy Anatomy, we have the very funny Vanessa Hollingshead. Vanessa is a stand-up and has toured around the country and around the world. She's appeared on Comedy Central Presents, The Jim Brewer Show, and in this great, great movie, if you have not seen, I cannot recommend enough, called Ghost Dog. And most recently, Funny Women of a Certain Age.
So please enjoy our conversation with Vanessa Hollingshead.
Well, thank you so much for being on our little show.
Yes.
So how did you get started in comedy? What led you into it?
My roommate, actually, Colette, and we're still friends, and this was 30 years ago. I was working as a secretary or administrative assistant, and she said, when you talk about your day at work, I laugh harder than any of the sitcoms I see on TV. You should try stand-up comedy. I was like, oh, no, I'm an actress. I would never do that. And she said, no, I think you might be really good at it. And then I went on stage for the first time 30 years ago at Gladys's Comedy Club. And I was number 36. I remember having like half a pack of cigarettes and 5 Diet Cokes and pretzels. And I got all the girls from the office to come, and they were half falling asleep. The audience was half falling asleep. It was finally my time to go on, my first time ever. And everyone was staring at me. And then I just looked at the audience and I'm like, you guys are so tired. I could be Richard Pryor right now doing some material and no one would laugh. He wouldn't even get laughs with you guys. And everyone burst out laughing. It was something that happened to me. I just was like, this feels so right to me. I'm at home. This is my little home. This is some little place to call my own. And that was a sense that all I have to do is get funny. Just get funny. Mm-hmm.
Just get good at this. But you found being yourself was the way to do it, right? Just talk about all of those things.
Yeah. Usually women that had to work for a living, the working class, I really identified with them. So I would do material about working, about being an office worker and the crap you go through with your boss and who can't identify with that. And then having hippie parents, you know, that did drugs and I was the straight daughter and just my life. I was able to just make my life funny that was basically tragic. And I was working with and all these actresses. I would do shows with them, plays that would be too embarrassing for me to invite an agent to. And I'll never forget doing this one show. It was our moment to shine on stage. We did Graceland. I was playing a woman that was obsessed with Elvis Presley. And my scene partner, my fellow actor, I was on stage with her. We're getting ready to go on. She's like, I'm really tired. I might do my monologue really slow. And I was ready to kill her. And I said, well, why don't you have some coffee? Because I'm wide awake. And we got a show to do. And I was like, if I just do comedy and write, I'm responsible. I don't have to rely on anybody. And there was a joy in not relying on anybody. I also used to be a musician. I had a band. I started a band when I was 16, then had one when I was 20. And I was always the one doing the hustling and the work and trying to get the gigs. I thought, if I just do stand-up, I don't have to worry about anybody else except myself, and I don't have to be accountable to anyone except myself. And there was a responsibility that came with that, but there was also a joy and a freedom and an independence that came with that. And I think for me, being always at the mercy of all kinds of people, it was very good for me to have that kind of independence.
Right. And this was all in New York, right? Obviously. So who did you start out with? Who were the people you came up with at the time?
Jim Gaffigan. David Tell had been doing it for a while. Well, Jessica Kirsten, the comedians that it's like I had a huge development deal that went south, but that was like my 2 years in, I was on my way to go up and I turned down the Drew Carey show, which was probably the biggest mistake I ever made. And
why did you turn it down?
Because they wanted me to play a cop on this show called The Billy Club, CBS. I did a 13-minute tape that got me 60 meetings in L.A. And they gave me a pilot of The Drew Carey Show. Didn't do it for me. And then I talked about having hippie parents with NBC. And then they went on and did Dharma and Greg that year. So I feel like they lifted my idea and just made Dharma a little bit younger and then made the husband straight. So, you know, but it was interesting that year was the year that I pitched my show.
You were always into writing too, Vanessa. You wrote a lot.
Always wrote a lot. And Mo always believed in me. I was always at the Boston and you were always put me up. You'd always use me. You were always there for me. And Mo has been solid. And he always made me feel great when I did the Patrice O'Neill roast, and he believed in me and he believed in that roast. I've never forgotten how supportive and loving you've been for me all these years.
I still am. I still love you.
And you still are. Still is. Yeah.
It's never gone away.
Always loved and appreciated me as an artist and as a person.
He's a good man, Masavia.
Making me cry now. Let's turn the tables on.
So how did you, when you started in comedy, I mean, it's really more of a marathon than a sprint. I think we can all agree.
It should have been a sprint, but no, this time it was a marathon. I remember Lucian, the guy, I ended up marrying him. And I remember, like, I was very cocky, but I was very sure of myself. And I went from being the hottest thing in New York and LA to going ice cold in about 6 months. And I didn't do anything. I didn't do anything except pick the wrong door. It was like, let's make a deal. Door number one, two, or three. And I picked door number three, and it was door number one. And Drew Carey went off to be a great hit. And I even gave acting lessons to Krista Miller. So you got to imagine when I was watching that show, watching the ratings go up and watching my show go down the toilet, I was like, wow. And
I can imagine too, when I also hear other comedians, I'm sorry, I didn't mean to cut you off, Vanessa, but
no,
I was just thinking, when you're saying this, it's like, we in that era of time in the 90s, there were so many development deals. They were handed out like, you go to Montreal, somebody would manage you, and you would get a deal, and you get your 100,000 or whatever it was, the hold, and it didn't work out. And so a lot of guys banked on that.
Oh, yeah, it was brutal. I mean, I remember Lucian said to me, he was at the time, I wasn't seeing him at the time, but he told me, he said, you might only get one chance to make a first impression. I'm like, I'll get another chance. I mean, I'm talented. And he said, no, you might have just shot your last wad. And yep. I remember, that just kind of threw me. I said, well, what do I do? It was, well, you were lucky and you made a poor choice and now you're going to have to get funny.
Right. Wow. And just for people who don't know, Lucian managed...
Comic strip, yes.
Comic strip, sorry. For us non-New Yorkers, he managed the comic strip and was a staple in New York.
Well, he knew comedy and he could really identify careers, and like he was the liaison between industry and the comedy.
He knew no talent. Like he discovered, he didn't discover Chris Rock, but he knew Chris, it was Eddie Murphy that told Lucian to put Chris Rock on. But he knew Adam Sandler, he believed in Adam Sandler, he believed in Aziz Ansari. There was a whole bunch of comedians he believed in, and he developed, and he loved comedians. He didn't, you know, I go to clubs now, and this is what I hear. You're funny. I said, oh, thank you. Did you see my show? No. I heard the audience laughing. That's all I need to know. And I'm like, Lucian would be turning in his grave. He'd be like, he would be like, you didn't even watch the comedian performing. You just heard the laughter. I mean, they could have been doing dick jokes or fart jokes, and you would, as long as my audience is happy.
You were married to Lucian, right?
Yeah, we were married. We were together for 10 years and married for 14 months. He died 14 months after we got married.
Oh.
With scleroderma. But if you see, and Colin Quinn used to be a waiter used to be a bartender at the comic strip, and he fired him. He said, you know, if you want to be a comedian, I'm going to have to fire you as a bartender. And he did. Colin did all right for himself.
He did.
That was the best move ever.
Wow, yeah. That's great. So what happened?
He'd make comedians cry. I mean, the first time I auditioned for the comic strip, I was in there for an hour. And he was just talking. And it's like, he would just talk and talk and talk. And you would just listen. But he really loved the art form, and he really loved and believed in comedians, you know, more than any booker I'd ever met.
Yeah, that's rare when you have people who are that committed to the craft and helping comics. But okay, so you come back, you know, you're saying, oh, you, whatever Lucian said about it, you might have blown it that one opportunity. Why didn't you quit? Why did you say, well, I'm not giving up?
It was like the biggest challenge. I just had to take that leap of faith. You know, there's a scene in Raiders of the Lost Ark where he's getting ready to cross the bridge. You know, there's a bridge, but there is no bridge. And you just have to, and as soon as he had that faith, that bridge appeared. And that was that leap of faith I had to take. And I tell everybody, there's a point where you're working, you're temping, you're doing day jobs and you're hanging out till two. I used to do falafel spots at the Cellar. It took Esty, I think, 2 years before she finally passed me. I would just eat falafel, wait there till two, and open for and would go on right after Artie Farquhar. I think I had the last spot. I mean, it was brutal, but it really made you got you strong. And there was a point when I was at the Cellar where they used to bark to get people into the Comedy Cellar. Like they couldn't. You remember those days, Mo?
Yes, I remember. But it was. I think it was all about the comedy. It was really about the skill. Yeah. We didn't have Facebook and Instagram and all these things that are distractions. You had to really be funny.
Yeah. Well, you know what? You mentioned somewhere where a cruise ship really saved you.
Yes.
Can you talk about that?
This was with Royal. I was barely able to make ends meet. I had a roommate. I was living on like maybe $12,000 to $13,000 a year. I mean, I was hurting and I had to have a roommate and I was just scraping by. It wasn't unusual for me to get tuna fish and I would have some, my cat would have the rest. And and someone that knew Lucian, Bruce Smirnoff, he said, you know, could you do like a clean set? Can you come down to Florida where they want to audition you for Royal Caribbean? I said, Bruce, I can't. I could just about pay my rent. And he said, well, send me what you got. And I sent this drinking set I did. And then he said, you know, a lot of people in the office really like it. They just like it. It's edgy, but it's not offensive. And then he said, all right, we're going to send it to Royal. They sent it to all the people in Royal. And he's like, you know what? They're going to take a chance on you. Don't fuck it up. And my first week on Royal, the main guy got sick. So there I was on a new ship with motion sickness. And I just had to almost do double the amount of time. And I got 24 dates. And then when I started doing more joking with material, like I got less laughs and I did solid material. And then as I started to get more comfortable, because we were doing 17 shows a week, I started to do crowd work with the audience and fell in love with it. And it was like I had no jokes. And also if you were a woman, they put you through your changes. There wasn't a lot of women that did ships. So, and I remember going into a depression thinking I'd be on the ships overeating, vaping, smoking, and just wanting to like, this is like a day job. This is like you are a cruise comedian. You're not Vanessa
right.
performing.
Yeah.
Royal Caribbean.
What's it like to work on these cruise ships? Do you bump into guests do you have to stay below deck? I mean, how does it work?
Yeah, it's pretty bad. And then they come back, when I was doing all the crowd work, they come back to the show, sit up front with their friends, come back again, sit up front. And then if the cruise director would see you just pass by and see you talk to the audience, he would think you didn't have jokes. Or if he watched you for a few minutes and maybe you weren't getting a laugh because you were asking questions, oh, not funny, get rid of it. Like, that was how fast. Whoopi Goldberg said, you can let what's going on in comedy and in life make you dark and bitter and angry, or you could start writing smarter. And it was like...
Right.
It was like a light bulb. Like Whoopi literally, I never met her, just changed the way my perception. And I'm like, write
smarter.
And I just decided to make it more personal and work a little bit smarter. But it was Whoopi that was the turning point of me not being so depressed. It was like my way out. It was like the key to unlock a door to get through it, to get to the next level.
Did your comedy get better from there? Did you think that helped your comedy?
Well, what happened is I was so depressed when I found out that they pulled my dates. And Carol Montgomery, who did Funny Women of a Certain Age, which was the highest rated Showtime comedy special for 2019, she said, can you do a set at the Crane? It was a tiny little theater seated like maybe 25 people. And I said, can I talk about anything I want? Can I be myself? Can I just do my thing? She's like, do anything you want. Anything. Do anything you want. And I was depressed. It was raining. My hair was like this. And I got like a huge, you know, almond croissant. I'm like, fuck this whole fucking business. You know, I was just like, let me just, and I had the croissant. And I was feeling great about I was like, it was like crack, you know, because you do the keto, no sugar, wheat, and flour. And then when you binge, you binge. Okay. So I did, I came on stage. I was like on fire, like all that sugar just kicked in. And I started joking with the girls and joking with this and doing the crowd work and blah, blah. And then I went into my porn bit, my French porn bit. And Carol said 9 of those people were from Showtime. And then Carol said, listen, we might be getting a Showtime special. And I'm like, yeah, no, that'd be nice. That'd be nice, yeah. And then a few months later, you know, it's getting close. We might get the special. I'm like, no, that'd be great. That'd be great. And then she goes, you need to sit down. We're getting the Showtime special, and we're getting it because of that French porn bit you did at the end.
Wow, that's great.
Yeah, it was the greatest feeling. And then 6 months later, they got another one, and now she's doing a third. It wasn't a one-trick pony. We have a voice being over 50, and everyone wants to hear it. And you've got all these seasoned, smart, funny women.
Right.
That have so much to talk about and so much life experience. And we have fun. And I certainly have fun joking with young people, joking with young guys. I always have a fun time with the young
people. Did you find it harder for, when we did an interview with DC Benny, and he was saying how Patrice told him one day, stop giving a fuck. And when you stop giving a fuck, things just open up, right? But do you think that doesn't apply to women?
My persona is like a big sister, a New York City girl that, you know, confidently underconfident, but big sister, I'll look out for you kind of energy. Women have a different, I don't care what you say, we're not treated the same. It's not the same. Mm-hmm. And then there was a show that came out about women, you know, women comedians. And a lot of us had to appear like we'd sleep with you. We did sleep with you, you know, do what we ever had to do, look cute, smile. There was a lot of that going on, and it still goes on. It's just gone underground. It's like all the stuff has just gone underground. We just use different words for it, but it's all there.
What's more exposed now, I would say, right? You were probably thinking, oh, I knew about this already. This has been around when all of a sudden it's today. Yeah. Talk about it.
Yeah. But the one good thing is like, it's not so easy for someone to say, hey, nice ass, you know, really?
Right.
And they're like, oh shit, this is the fucking hashtag.
I think I'm gonna call somebody right now.
Yeah. You pull out your phone. Tick, 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 tick.
Phone call. You hold that thought, pal. I'm going to make a phone call. So
yeah,
that's gotten a little bit better.
I'm always interested with comedians when things aren't so great, what prevents you from just switching gears to something else, but not doing that, sticking with it and persevering.
I was down to everything. I put in that weekend, I prayed to God. I'm pretty spiritual. I prayed to God. I put in 4 applications to Starbucks, having sent my tape, my link on my drinking to Bruce Smirnoff for Royal Caribbean. He was with Don Casino, which was one of the biggest ship agents around. And I thought I'll just work at Starbucks. So Louis C.K. will walk into Starbucks. Sarah Silverman will walk into Starbucks, and I'll just make them a latte, and it'll be between me and God. Maybe God wants to humble me. I've tried. And I remember just crying, and like, I have tried so hard to do the right thing. And I remember I put those applications in, and I said, I can't live like this. I can't pay the bills. I can't make ends meet. I guess this is my time. I had a good like 22 year run or 23 year run. It's how it's meant to be. But I kept saying this between me and God. It has nothing to do with my talent. It's something I need, some lesson in humility I need to learn. And that weekend, that Monday, Bruce said, they're going to take a chance on you and put you on the ships.
Oh, wow.
4 years of the, I did a, 4 years of the ships before this stuff went down, and was able to get myself out of debt. And then right after that, when I was at a low point again, was when Funny Women of a Certain Age happened. And this was the time that we were supposed to get on Broadway. We were going to go to Vegas. We were going to do a tour. And then March 16th of 2020, life as I knew it ended, we lost everything. And for the first time in my life, I'd never gone more than 2 weeks without doing a set. Even when on my honeymoon, I did a set in the south of France and in Amsterdam. I just, it was a time to regroup and ask yourself, where are your values? What matters to you?
To dig deep, right? You had to really
dig deep.
Yeah.
And I remember I was just, again, beside myself. And there was this empty feeling. I realized how I'd always can run to danger fields. I could always run here. I could always run there. I could always have my notes ready to work on this and that. And even if I wasn't dating anybody, I always felt, you know, I never felt alone. I felt wanted to be in a relationship, but if it didn't work out, I always had that audience. That audience was kind of like my relationship. Mm-hmm. And when that ended, this emptiness came over me, and I realized that I had made my career and what people think of me more important than what I thought of myself.
Wow.
And more important than human connection. That if I would do a gig, I would cancel seeing a friend. I made comedy the most important thing, and wound up not being able to get pregnant because by the time I did, I was 38, found out I couldn't have children. I had given up everything to have this career. So when I would talk to comedians or teach comedians, I'd say, no, you can't do a bunch of Zoom shows or just hang out at a club when you got your day job and think this okay. No, you got to really either come up with a viral TikTok video or a YouTube thing, or be at a club 5-6 nights a week, or be so funny, or do a combination of them all. Like, that's not going to end. But that was that was a turning point. And then something I'll never forget, you know, and I went into more prayer. I went into meditation. I would sometimes curl up in the fetal position. I just was so lost without doing this. But I realized that, and then something came over me. I just remember hitting tennis balls like against a wall just by myself, teaching myself tennis. And it was freezing cold. And my life felt so, and I felt so sorry for myself. I'm like, I'm alone in a tennis court hitting tennis balls. I broke up with this piece of crap guy, and I just started to hit tennis balls. And then one day I was like listening to my music, getting better with hitting the tennis balls. It'd be winter, I'd be just hitting them. And then I was working on my series with Jeannie, my writing partner. We're still working on it, trying to get this outline done. And we were nonstop. So every chance I had, it was working on a TV series. And I'll never forget, I was doing something, and this joy came, this happiness came over me. And I was just looking at my cat, and I was just like doing like a little, like, you know, it's like, it's gonna be all right. I'm like, I'm not drinking. I'm not high. I'm not in love. I'm okay here. I'm okay here. Like something kind of shifted. So, you know, my career might have gotten taken away from me, but I found a little piece of myself, you know,
that's great.
I thought I never knew I had.
Did that stick? Did that stay with you from then on? Or is it ebbs and flows?
It ebbs and flows, but it's always kind of there. Like I had a altercation this weekend, and I could have reamed this woman a new one and said, "What, you self-hating management bitch to fucking see me in some twisted backward way." And she's screaming at me, and I'm just listening. And I'm listening, and I'm like, the person who has the most power is the one that says the least. I'm like, I don't know what, the last time I checked, I was a nice person, you know? And I thought, wow, she's projecting her crap. She's seeing something in me, in her. She's decided to hate me. Probably never gonna work at this club again, having done nothing wrong. And I was up the entire night, and I was gonna write her an apology letter, like kiss her ass. And I thought, no, I'm going to walk away. I know who I am.
Yeah,
and if I don't know who I am, I have friends that tell me who I am. And instead of listening to the crazy voice in my head that says, you're not good enough, it's all an act, you're not really a comedian, you're an actress posing as a comedian, nothing's really going to work out, people are full of shit, there is no karma, there is no God, you can lie to yourself if you want. Instead of doing that, I'm just going to listen to my friends. And sometimes, like God or kindness or angels, they show up in the form of people. You know, that's what happens. And I decide, and that my my instinct and my intuition was now getting stronger, and that's kind of what happened. And I thought, I'm out of a club. That's all right. And then the next day, this guy wanted to use me for some work. And I said to myself, I'm not going to be intimidated when a club owner won't use me, or when some fucking piss-ass manager that has some weird issues with me. And I thought, I never did anything wrong to this woman. And matter of fact, I used to be on eggshells. Like, is that all right? Do you mind? It's like, I got you. You kiss so much ass after a while that you just get used to kissing ass. Like, it's
right.
Yeah, no. Okay, I can't. I can only work in a 20-mile radius from that club, or you won't use me for 3 months. Okay, no. My loyalty is to you. Like, it's like they're the fucking mafia. Like, these bookers are the mafia, and they control you. Like, it's like, you don't cover my health insurance. I don't have like a pension with you. This is all I've got. And you think if I'm in some bum fuck club somewhere and it's 30 minutes away, oh, well, because Vanessa's going to be here in March, we're not going to see her in May at this club. It's all bullshit. And I thought, you know what? Let me just have God be my personal manager. And if it's not meant to happen, it's not going to happen. And the second I kind of believe that, everything shifted. It's like they say in like a Chinese philosophy, you can't, the teacher can't come to you if you keep holding the hand of the child. And I'm like, as long as I'm intimidated by the smaller people, they're going to keep me small. But if I just say, go open my hands and go, all right, no, you won't anymore. And there was this strength in, within 24 hours, I thought, I'm not going back to that club. I don't care what happens. And I'm never going to be intimidated by another booker again, or another, you know, two-bit waitress, manager, whatever she was, to make me feel bad about myself.
Well, what do you think about management and over the years, let's say, compared to then in the 90s when now, what do you think about management, agents and bookers and all of those people? I mean, what category or how, I mean, you don't have to say the full thing if it's violence, but like, what do you think of the place that the role they play in comedians' lives, and compared, I mean, to your life in that sense?
I think years ago they had like a hands-on. They would take their notepad. They would go to the club. They would develop you like they used to develop, like, you know, David Geffen would develop.
Right.
Yeah.
Develop people. I don't know.
I saw the specialty. Yeah.
Believe in them. Started, and that's how bookers were, or a booker or an agent or manager just saw something special, and you would just kind of work together. You go, leave that joke. Now it's like, now it's got this like,
if you have a bunch of followers on Instagram kind of thing.
Yeah,
or?
Yeah, like a bunch of followers on Instagram, or you're adorable.
So what do you tell young, what do you tell young comics? So you're the big sister. What kind of advice would you give a young comic starting out?
I would tell them, write, do as many spots as you can, really try and identify your voice. Never be afraid to look nice on stage. Don't feel like, and just kind of know who you are, and not try and follow or be anyone else. And just ask yourself, why do I have to say something? What is it about my funny way of looking at things, or my way of looking at things that's different and original? Why? Because we're going to do the same material. We're going to do sex jokes, relationship jokes, work jokes, but it's the way that they're done. And to just not, and don't be sexual for the sake of being sexual, and don't be woke and PC for the sake of trying to be okay. Like, I love what George Carlin said when someone heckled him. He's like, you know what? I'm not up for the double standard. How about one standard? One standard will do just fine. I don't mind you getting, don't get offended by one joke and cherry pick everything and not see the context. If I'm talking about racism or greed or relationships, just see that I'm doing a whole body of work. Have the decency to listen to my whole set before you cherry pick and just write me off.
So what do you have? Is this show that you have that closed down for the pandemic, Women of a Certain Age, is that right? That,
no, we kept
oh, you
it
did
going.
Keep it going. Okay, good. So
all
so,
the pandemic, we would go to the, it would be just me and Carol and another comedian. We would go to the Crane and in front of a Zoom camera, perform our show.
I saw that.
An empty theater.
Yes. Wow. So now that things are lifting though, What is there movement? Are there things moving back to where the excitement was before, or is it starting over a little bit?
We're hoping that this time next year, everything will pick up momentum. The one
and you know what, on this note too, I see you will be at the Lincoln Center. You have some stuff coming up. I mean, people can check it out, but, and I recommend that everyone see you. But I'm going to see you at the Lincoln Center. I'm going to go see it, but that's a great lineup. And I'm glad things are sort of moving in that direction where
starting to move. And we're trying to sell a show that we wrote because my dad was responsible for giving LSD to Timothy Leary, and Timothy Leary got all the credit. My dad was basically written out of history. So we're working on that series. It's like, you know, if The Crown was on LSD, that's basically the show we did. And then it's never been a show about.
Wow. That's cool. With Timothy Leary and Ram Dass was a part of that, right?
Yeah, and I took LSD by accident when I was 5. And Baba Ram Dass gave me a shot of Thorazine in my ass.
I want to thank you too.
It was my pleasure. I went off. I can't believe I went off.
No, it was great.
And I'm going to tell you from this point of view, I think you're going to be the most successful right now. This is your time because you're truthful.
See how it makes me feel good about myself?
This is the best.
Okay. And give me 10% when you.
I will. And Mo, thank you from the bottom of my heart for always loving me and believing in me, because I can count on my hands the people in this business that actually care about you as an artist and as a person. And you're one of them, Mo.
Thanks so much for talking to us.
Okay. Hope to see you around. Okay.
For sure. Thank you.
Okay, Mo, let them know how they can support us.
Make sure to subscribe to Comedy Anatomy and give us a review on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or wherever you listen. And don't forget to follow us on Instagram @Comedy Anatomy and on Twitter @Comedy_Anatomy.